From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Celeste Headlee. So how do you respond to those unwanted phone calls?
I waste their time because I feel like they're stealing time from me. So I say, yeah, hang on just a second, let me get him. And wait a really, really, really long time and make noise in the background so they have hope.
That's David Spencer of Atlanta. People in his area code get more robocalls than anyone else in the country. Coming up, we're going to talk about how to handle the onslaught. But first, last week, The Break Room talked about a South Carolina teacher who asked fifth graders to imagine that they were KKK members and to justify their actions.
You know, it's not about not talking about the KKK. We need to talk about the KKK. We need to talk about issues of race. We need to talk about a whole bunch of things. But there is something that is called being age appropriate.
That's Break Room regular Nasenga Burton. Here are your first thoughts. Marie Mower writes to us, my concern is why teach our young kids this information where white people didn't like black people and treated them terribly? It's a constant message in elementary school in Atlanta and seems to lay a foundation in their brains to see white and black very differently. It's really at their teacher's discretion on how much and the depth they explore this. I think it should be in the curriculum so a teacher doesn't go too far, such as the case of the KKK topic. Now, in marked contrast, Rabbit tweets to us, we did a reenactment of the John Brown slave rebellion in elementary school, and it was awesome. Well, we always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OSTTalk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Indigo Girls. No the there. It's not the Indigo Girls. It's just Indigo Girls. Indigo Girls have been making hits since their first release in 1985. One of the most successful and influential Georgia-formed groups, the folk rock pair have gone platinum and won a Grammy, too. They have a show tonight at 7:30 in Atlanta's Symphony Hall with the orchestra. Amy Ray, one half of the Indigo Girls duo, joined my colleague Celeste Headlee in July to talk about her new solo album.
You know, my first question is actually totally inconsequential and just to satisfy my curiosity, but there's a note in Wikipedia that says, you guys actually lost Best New Artist Grammy to Milli Vanilli. Is that correct?
That is true. We really did. Yeah. It was a long time ago.
Do you ever just look back at that and wonder about the path of fortune?
It was such a scandal at the time, but we remember. I think now it wouldn't be as big of a scandal, but we didn't mind. We actually, the Best New Artist, sometimes that award can be a bit of a curse because it's so much pressure, you know.
Yeah.
So we probably tried to look at it as a blessing in disguise.
How do you? I mean, the Grammy's not the only award you guys have won. How do you view awards like that? Are they helpful for an artist?
Sure. I mean, everything adds, you know, to the well. That's not why we do it, and we don't count on it. But when something like that happens, we're grateful for it, honestly, because it brings new people into the fold, and it's validating in some ways. So, but it's not, you know, the end all and be all of what we're doing.
So tell me a little bit about your songwriting, because I wonder if you, when you're writing a song, how you know whether it's best served as an Indigo Girls song or as an Amy Ray Band song.
Well, in the past, it was, I started doing solo music in 2001 because I was writing a lot of punk rock songs, and and I had a lot of friends that were playing punk rock, and I had an indie label, and I was putting out a lot of punk bands, so that was a very obvious differentiation, and it had more to do with who I was going to collaborate with on it. You know, as far as a writer, I'd write the song and I'd be thinking of, this is going to be a great song to play with the Rocketeens or the Butchies or Josephine Wiggs or Kate Schellenbach or, you know, some of my other friends, Joan Jett. And then when I started lately, you know, my last record was country, and it was traditional country and mountain music. And that was a little bit different because Emily and I, we do write stuff that could cross over into that category. But we've never been in country music, probably mostly because we're so left-wing and we're gay, and it wasn't really a place that where you could find a place in that. It was more like Americana. But I think lately country has opened up a lot too, and to different perspectives and styles. And So what I did, I love traditional country music, and I always have for so long, and I was writing songs in that vein, and I just found some other collaborators that were, you know, like a pedal steel player and a guitar player and a banjo player, people that I really loved, and I was like, you know, I think I found my people that I can make this record with.
Night, sweet tender, the veil is on the loom. Coyote sleeping is singing a lonesome tune. All my life I'm rambling, and so you're in my stead. I lie awake and wonder at every bedtime tale.
I think it's more like when I'm writing a song, if it's an Emily Amy song, Emily's not the same about this, but I really can hear her in my head when I'm writing, and she can be a catalyst for me sometimes, knowing what are the harmony parts that she might write, or the guitar or the banjo or the piano or whatever might go on it that she might do. So that's probably what dictates that. It just gets thrown into that category, and then I work on it in the light of in that kind of, with that lens.
So what is it about country music that you say that you like? What is it about that particular genre that you love?
I love good songwriting, and I love storytelling, and I have to admit, you know, I moved up to Dahlonega about 25 years ago, and being around all those players up there, it definitely got into my blood, you know, and when I was younger, I had listened to country and southern rock, but was writing more in the folk vein, and when I got into Dahlonega, I was like, it just kind of started coming out of me, especially, I think, the gospel style. I really like old school kind of field recordings from the mountains, and that just, I love that storytelling, and I think that's what it is for me. It's just the storytelling, and you know, country and punk are quite akin to each other, I would say. Like Hank Williams and The Clash have a lot of similarities in their song structure, so it, and it's both, it's very populist, you know, like, to me, the beauty of punk rock was that anyone can do it, and you just, it's three chords and the truth kind of thing, you know, and that's the beauty of country as well.
Well, the rock is my foundation, Jesus is at the base, God is on the kick drum, and the Holy Spirit sings.
You sing throated, just you leave it all on the stage. And I mean, I always wonder when I'm hearing you sing, I hear you sing recently and I think, wow, how was she able to sustain that? Like, how can you give it all and then still be singing 2 decades later? How do you protect your voice?
Oh, it's that the giving it all part is just passion. That's kind of always what I've had on my side, even when I wasn't really very good at what I was doing. Because I was so passionate about it, I could get away with it. But I just, you know, I actually do a lot of stuff. I have this DVD that I swear by that was made by a vocal instructor named Melissa Cross. It's called The Zen of Screaming. And it was made to teach heavy metal singers how to sing without losing their voice. And it actually changed my life. I started practicing the warm-ups and sort of being a devotee to her about 15 years ago. And or maybe 12, and ever since then, I've taken just much better care of my voice, and I warm up religiously, and I try to sing correctly, and you know, I can still yell and scream and belt it out and croon and do whatever, and it's just doing it the right way to keep me from losing my voice is what I do, and this came about after losing my voice a lot and needing some help and to figure out how to not do that, you know, because I would just lose my voice after 3 shows because I was just singing incorrectly or just yelling too much, you know, whatever, or talking too much after the show, things like that. So it's a lot of water and a lot of sleep when I'm on the road. And but now I have a 4-year-old, so I'm having to figure out how to what to do in that context, because you know, I sing to her all the time, and so sometimes I'll get onto my first show and I'm hoarse because I've been singing every night. to my baby late at night, you know. So I'm refiguring it out again.
How do you think parenthood has changed you as a musician? Has it changed maybe the sound or what you write about?
You know, it hasn't seeped into my writing quite yet. I'm sure it will. But it focuses you differently. You have to manage your time differently because you have small chunks of time instead of, I don't have 3 hours to sit and write at home, but I might have 30 minutes, you know. Or when she was really young and she took a lot of naps, I would just use her nap time to write. Or sometimes I would even have her nap in my studio and just rock the cradle with my foot while I was working on a song. And it worked for about 3 months, and then she got bored, I guess, and wouldn't sleep as much. I think it's like your time, you know, you have to reorganize your time. But for me, it hasn't necessarily come out in my lyrics yet. But it does give you a perspective on the world that's quite different and a little broader, I think, for me anyway, you know. And you know, you meet, obviously, because you have a child, you're meeting other parents and people from different walks of life and have different opinions, and it's really good. It really gets you outside of your bubble, and I think that's really important to hear what other people have to think about things. And so for me, I appreciate that too. You know, I don't try to just hang out with the same kind of person as I am, and having a child really puts you in situations where you're not. So you really have to learn to open up to people and be more social, and I'm a hermit, so it's really forced that for me.
So let's talk a little bit about the broader world, because, I mean, one of the things you have been known, you and Emily have been known from the very beginning, is as not just musicians, but activists. That's been a huge part of both your music and what you chose to do in your spare time. And I wonder how that has evolved and how that's looking under the administration of President Trump.
Well, some of our activism has spanned administrations. At this point, we're pretty old, so we've worked during a lot of administrations, and some of it spans through them and it's affected somewhat by them. But I would take, for instance, like our work with Native American issues. We started a group in the early 90s called Honor the Earth, and we fund Native-run groups that work on environmental and cultural sustainability. Now, that has been something that no matter who's in office, there's a lot of work to be done, because those groups are very disenfranchised and very much in sort of invisible to people. So that is an ongoing battle in some ways, but also an ongoing win, because some of these tribes are doing great things with alternative energy and developing market, you know, economic bases in their communities that are based on some kind of agricultural sustainability or energy sustainability. And so that work can be a really positive blessing to kind of work outside of the box and work with these, support these tribes that are doing such really a forward-looking work, you know.
That's Amy Ray. She performs with Emily Saliers as Indigo Girls tonight at Atlanta Symphony Hall. We'll have more from the conversation with Ray in just a minute. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Let's continue the conversation with Celeste and Amy Ray from Indigo Girls. Ray and her longtime musical collaborator Emily Saliers appear together as Indigo Girls tonight in Atlanta. Here is Amy talking about her take on political activism.
But as far as, you know, human rights or civil rights or issues we work on, maybe gay issues or issues around immigration, I mean, it's greatly affected by who's the profile of the administration, I should say, you know. And so it just changes I'm a pretty optimistic person, and I'm also pretty optimistic about people. So I tend to just try to reach across the aisle, so to speak, and work with people coming from maybe a different perspective policy-wise, but are just compassionate people, and try to solve problems from that perspective. And I think living in Georgia, you know, for us, we've always kind of gone against the grain politically here, but we've also, it's where we love to be, and it's people that we love. And you find a way, it's really a great place to learn how to dialogue with people that feel differently than you do about things. And I think that that's good, and it's good for us, and it's a good way to build solutions. So I personally, I try not to let whoever is in charge affect me, and it does affect me because you see the dismantling of things that we've worked really hard on. But I also feel like you see opportunities to build bridges and to reach to communities that, you know, may become disenfranchised or are suffering and feel invisible. And I don't know how to. I think I'm just always been that kind of optimistic person, and I've always lived amongst people that where we have very big differences politically, and so I sort of just figure out how to keep going for the solutions and keep working to improve things. That's where I've always come from, even in my family, where we all felt differently about things.
So, I mean, Georgia is a pretty complicated place, not just politically, but in a lot of ways. I mean, there's a lot of very disparate people here. And I wonder if you hear that reflected in not just your music, but in Georgia music in general. What is the sound, do you think, of music from this state?
It's the sound is like the sound of the dirt. For me, it's like, even in hip hop, you know, and even in the most poppy music that comes out of Georgia, you can still hear that slow agricultural, you know, sitting on the front porch, talking to your neighbors, heat, sweat. You can hear it in every kind of music. And so I think that's the thread is cultural in some ways. You know, even when you're talking about, you know, burgeoning, you know, Hispanic communities that have music coming out of those communities. And so it's sweat, you know, sweat equity or something. I don't know. But it's and I know a lot it is complex because there's so many different kinds of music. And then you have your like Christian gospel scene, and you have like country, and it's from every walk of life. And that's the beauty of it. I mean, I love the South. I'm from about four generations have lived here. So, or five actually. So I just feel close to it, and I feel a kinship to it. It's a scene that I can relate to, but you're right. It's complex. It's very complex, and it's very different musically. And the great thing about Georgia is Georgia's getting more and more diverse. So I love the state, you know, generally, and I love the South. So for me, it's really exciting. And the music scene is part of it. You know, Georgia music is incredible. And then we have this incredible film and TV industry, and there's a lot of good things happening here.
Singer and songwriter Amy Ray. She's best known as a member of the Georgia-based duo Indigo Girls. Amy, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You too. I love your show. I listen to you all the time. So it's a pleasure to talk to you, actually.
I listen to you all the time.
Oh, really? I'm glad we could get together.
That makes my whole day. Thank you. Have a great
one.
No,
I do. I'm a GPB freak. So, yeah, I listen to you all the time.
Well, that is awesome to hear. Thank you on many levels.
That was singer and songwriter Amy Ray speaking with my colleague Celeste Headley. Celeste also interviewed Emily Salyers a few years back. Here is Salyers discussing one song, If I Don't Leave Here Now by the Indigo Girls.
The body of the song and sort of the melody of the chorus was written several years ago. I actually remember writing it when George Bush was elected for the second time. I was really depressed, but it was kind of a pop tune at that. It was really, if I don't leave here now. And then I wrote the lyrics, and then Jordan Hamlin, our producer, said, you know, if something wasn't sticking with the song, not for any of us. But Jordan said, you know, if you slowed this down and turned it into a ballad, I think it would come to life for me. And I trust her opinion on things. And so I did, and actually it became a very important song for me, and I think for the record.
They say if it ever was, it's in there still. You can dig and fill, and never will be full. Trying to get that good again. Your last fifth of Jack, a cigarette, the time you bet the farm before you lost it all. You want that feeling.
That's Emily Salyers of Indigo Girls. She performs with Amy Ray tonight in Atlanta Symphony Hall. Show starts at 7:30. Just ahead, we discuss classical music's diversity problem, but first, how to stop those annoying robocalls. Atlanta gets more robocalls than any other city in the United States. If that's not bad enough, in August, the city broke its own record for the number of times that pre-recorded or human commercial pests, pleaders, and politicians annoyed people on the phone in a single month. On top of that, Hurricane Irma only made this problem worse, if you can imagine such a thing. Joining us now is Maureen Mahoney, public policy fellow at Consumers Union. She studies the robocall scourge and ways to address it. Thanks for being here, Maureen.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We spoke to some people in Atlanta who have had personal troubles with robocalls. Let's listen to a couple of them.
Hi, my name is Sunny Desai. I did a health insurance quote online, and from that point, I guess my information was sold amongst various companies, so I'm getting calls currently all the time from different insurance companies, robocalls from them telling me that my health insurance plans are going to end in Georgia, and they have new offers available to me.
Now, here's Georgia resident David Spencer talking about what he does when he gets certain calls and what he does to the people calling him.
They're in the evening when you kind of don't want to be disturbed. Dinner time usually is when they plan it. I waste their time because I feel like they're stealing time from me. So I say, yeah, hang on just a second. Let me get him. And wait a really, really, really long time and make noise in the background so they have hope.
Okay. So David and Sonny there are describing, it seems to me, two separate phenomena. One is getting a call from a robot from a pre-recorded thing. Another is getting a call from a human. Maureen, would you consider these both to be examples of robocalls?
Yes, we would consider any unwanted, automated, or pre-recorded call to be a robocall. We regularly hear from consumers that they're just inundated with these calls and they're fed up.
Is it our imagination that it's getting worse?
No. Information from the Federal Trade Commission indicates that the problem is getting worse. Complaints about violations of the Do Not Call list are up last year. They're up from last year. They're up to over 5 million from over 3.5 million last year.
Okay. One thing that I've noticed is that ever since I took landlines out of my life, which was quite some time ago, I sort of stopped getting junk phone calls. I used to only get those on my landline. Now I'm getting them on my cell again, and it's not so great. What's up with that? How are they finding me? They found my landline because it was in the phone book. How are they finding my cell?
Right. We're hearing the same thing from many consumers. For a long time, it seemed that consumers weren't receiving unwanted calls to their cell phones, but more and more they are getting these calls. So many of these calls are coming from scammers who use random and sequential dialing to reach consumers. So as more and more consumers drop home phones and move to cell phones, it's more likely that they'll eventually get calls on these numbers. And, you know, the more you give out your number and write your number down on applications, the more likely it is that you'll get unwanted calls. So that's something to keep in mind as well.
Sure, yeah. There are things you can do to, unfortunately, invite this kind of attention upon yourself, like giving your number to someone who you probably shouldn't trust. But you're talking about sequential dialing. So they've got computers. They're literally dialing 1234567. 2234567, 3234567, just trying random numbers, and they're going to find you that way at some point, right?
Right. So, for example, when the IRS scam was particularly affecting consumers, you know, we'd see just consumers all across the country eventually emailing us, contacting us that they were affected by these calls. So it appears that, you know, everyone is vulnerable to these types of calls.
Sure. We're talking about robocalls and all manner of unwanted commercial, political phone calls that we tend to get a lot. It's not your imagination. The problem is getting worse, and Atlanta actually suffers this problem worse of all major American cities, we are told. And we're speaking to Maureen Mahoney, public policy fellow at Consumers Union. She studies this issue and ways to address it. One of the things that is concerning is that, as you said, Maureen, robocalls aren't just being done by people trying to sell people stuff. They're being done by people trying to scam people. And if you are someone who is particularly susceptible to scamming, they find that out. How?
Well, if you've fallen victim to a scam in the past, you're much more likely to get more scam calls because scammers do sell lists of potential leads to other scammers. So things you can do to try to avoid being the victim of a phone scam is letting unfamiliar calls go to voicemail. If you do pick up the phone and there's an unfamiliar caller at the other end, just hang up. Don't worry about being rude. It's much better to be safe than sorry.
Sure, yeah. Let's talk about some other strategies for dealing with this proactively. Here is Carol Gray talking about the way that she deals with the robocalls that she gets on her cell phone.
I get them on my cell phone now, and I have an app on my phone that blocks them because you get the call, and it's the same voice every time that says, "Hi, this is Eric calling from," and they're just annoying.
And now let's hear from another Georgian talking about what he does when he gets a robocall.
Yeah, my name is David Traeger. Usually when I get robocalls, I either usually just hang up or I find out what the name of the company is because I want to try and figure out if there's a way to stop it. Usually when they call, like, I just ask them to put me on their do not call list, but that never works.
So, Maureen, does that work sometimes? Should it work, asking to be removed from a company's call list?
Well, if it's a legitimate company, it should work. They are required to stop calling you if you request it. But if it's a scammer, they're not going to respect your wishes. They're violating the do not call list already. So it's best just not to engage with a scammer. But if you do know it's a legitimate company, we recommend contacting them directly and asking them to stop calling you.
What about technological solutions? We just heard from a woman saying that she has an app on her smartphone that somehow blocks robocalls. Is that a thing? Are there things that people can download?
Right. There are existing technologies that can automatically identify and block unwanted robocalls. We think that everybody should have access to this type of technology, and we're calling on the phone companies to offer it to all consumers for free. Unfortunately, relatively few consumers have access to these types of technologies. There are smartphone apps that are out there. If you have a more advanced landline phone, such as Verizon Fios, Comcast Xfinity, AT&T U-verse, your phone is compatible with a tool called NomoRobo, which automatically identifies and blocks robocalls, and that's for free to home phones. Volunteer testers for Consumer Reports rated it highly. But if you have a traditional landline, unfortunately, there are relatively few options out there. Your best option may be purchasing a call blocking device online or at an electronics store that can make it easier to block certain numbers. But those can be pricey, about $50 to $100, unfortunately.
Well, listeners, we want to know how you handle unwanted phone calls, junk phone calls. Give us a call, ironically, at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. Maureen, lastly, let me ask you, when you get a phone call from a human telemarketer or someone, an actual human calling you with a junk phone call, how do you handle it?
Well, actually, if I don't recognize the number, I just don't pick up. And I think that's the best strategy for consumers.
Okay, but assuming you do, I don't know. I understand people, you know, blowing off a little bit of steam and getting upset at the person calling them. But ultimately, I just feel bad about it because it's somebody like making a minimum wage. It's not their fault, right?
Well, one of the problems is that sometimes the scam telemarketers can be really nasty to consumers and abusive. We hear from consumers all the time that they've had a really upsetting interaction with a telemarketer. So we would advise consumers to avoid that. But I know a lot of consumers out there like messing with telemarketers. There's even a new tool called the Jolly Roger Telephone Company that uses the same technology that robocallers use to tie up, you know, telemarketers' lines that keep responding to the telemarketers' questions. But, you know, we recommend best policy is just to hang up.
All right. That's very adult of you. That is Maureen Mahoney, Public Policy Fellow at Consumers Union. Really useful tips. Thank you very much, Maureen.
Thank you.
Coming up, we take a look at how classical music can become more inclusive. It's on Second Thought. On Second Thought, I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. The world of classical music has a diversity problem. The League of American Orchestras says people of color make up only about 4% of U.S. symphony players. In Georgia, the Atlanta Music Project is working to balance those scales, also known as AMP, Atlanta Music Project, AMP. The program provides free training and instruments to underserved students in Southwest Atlanta. AMP recently won a grant of $80,000 from the Carnegie Hall Foundation, one of only 13 awarded across the country. And with me now is Dante Rameau, co-founder and executive director of the Atlanta Music Project. Hi, Dante.
Good morning, Adam.
Glad to have you. Also with us from Detroit is Rick Robinson, who's the founder of Cut Time Productions, which works to make classical music more accessible to a wider audience. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Hi, guys.
I note that before we start talking about your respective programs and the work that you're doing, you're both men of color who play classical music for a living, and I wonder if you couldn't both just tell us a little bit about how you came to be who you are, how you came to find that career. Dante, could you start with us? Let's start with you, Dante. Got it right. Okay.
Sure. I grew up in Canada, and my parents are my dad is from Haiti, and my mom is from Cameroon. And they just wanted me exposed to as many different extracurriculars as possible. And for whatever reason, the one that they didn't give me a choice about was piano lessons. I was allowed to play basketball and do other kinds of activities, but they forced me to do piano. And I had a knack for it, and they supported my progress. And I ended up going to a magnet high school for the arts, where I majored in bassoon and saxophone. And it just came easily, and the hard work part of it I always enjoyed. So I ended up going to do a Bachelor of Music and a Master of Music.
And Rick, how did you fall into this?
Well, I grew up in a musical family. My older brother and sister played violin and cello, and then David took up bass and saxophone. Our mother played piano and sang at the piano, and she loved going through the classical repertory at the piano. It just moved her so much. And then my father taught himself guitar, and he'd do folk singing, and he'd lead audiences. So my whole family has been musical and leaders in the community.
So, Dante, what does the Atlanta Music Project do?
Well, the Atlanta Music Project is now in its eighth year of operations. And what we do is we provide intensive music education for underserved youth right in their neighborhood. And a lot of people ask me, well, Dante, what do you mean by underserved? And what we'll do is we'll look at neighborhoods and communities in metropolitan Atlanta and identify areas where you might not find a lot of youth orchestras or youth choirs, or you might not find very robust music programs in the schools. So we're targeting musically underserved neighborhoods. But this usually is found in neighborhoods where you have a lot of schools with high rates of free reduced lunch students, and also neighborhoods where there are lower levels of income. So we tend to end up in neighborhoods south of I-20 in Atlanta.
Let's listen to some of your kids. Here is the Amp Orchestra performing Fanfare for the Common Man by Aaron Copland last year. So Dante Rameau, a lot of the kids you can see in this video are very, very young, and I imagine you're starting them late in a lot of circumstances. They sound pretty good nonetheless. What is your goal? What do you consider success with these kids?
Well, becoming a musician, proficient on a music instrument requires a lot of skills and character traits that I think are valuable and applicable to all parts of your life. So mostly I want our kids to feel a very high sense of self-worth. I want them to feel like they matter and like their voice matters and that they can do really big things. And we just happen to be using music as a vehicle. You can do it through sports. You can do it through academics. We just happen to be doing it through music. So an example is we've got three students who this summer got to participate in a national music festival called Take a Stand in Los Angeles, and they got to perform at Walt Disney Concert Hall, home of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, under the baton of Gustavo Dudamel, the famous conductor. And, you know, this is all due to their hard work and their dedication to their craft. And I think when they have those kinds of experiences, I think they feel like they have more control over the outcome in their lives.
Rick Robinson with Cut Time Productions in Detroit. You're doing different things to try to make classical music more accessible to people who might not necessarily normally find it or be exposed to it. You've got this group called the Cut Time Players. It's an octet. And let's go ahead and just play some of that music so that people can hear how lively your concerts are from time to time. I'm being told we don't have that clip, but it's very, very lively music.
Oh, no.
Right. Now I'm being told stand by, so hold on. They're going to start playing the music underneath you. Just go ahead and tell us about the Cut Time Players.
Okay, well, I started it back in 1994 while I was a member of Detroit Symphony Orchestra, and I realized that there are a lot of people who never come to Orchestra Hall to hear us, so we should be taking the music to them. And eventually, once the smoking laws came along, grew this movement called Classical Revolution that began in San Francisco. And I joined that in organizing music volunteers in restaurants and clubs and bars to start sharing classical music as entertainment in those places so we could reach a new audience.
And yeah, the concerts, if you people go and listen to the music online, they just sound like a whole lot of fun. Do you think that the mission is working?
I think it's growing. It necessarily starts small because we need to experiment for what people react most positively to. And, you know, it tends to be the cream of the crop, something familiar, something with a strong beat and ways that they can join in, like playing toy percussion with us.
That's great. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dante Rameau, executive director of the Atlanta Music Project, and also Rick Robinson, founder of Cut Time Productions in Detroit, two gentlemen who are trying to make classical music more accessible to a wider array of people. And Dante, I wonder, the argument that you make about the value of classical music education is very, very strong, and it's a very, very common argument. But it's, you know, it fundamentally is the case that historically speaking, classical music is a European tradition, and if kids, especially kids of color, don't find it to be really relevant to them, do you ever worry that maybe you're foisting European cultural hegemony on them?
No, I don't worry about that, because what we're doing is we're teaching kids the language of music. And we happen to start at the very beginning in a traditional Western music education philosophy, where you're learning to read notes and, you know, you're playing semitones and tones and half steps and whole steps and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, We're teaching them to play an instrument, and they now have the ability, once they get to a level of proficiency where they can read any kind of music, where they can play by ear, they can now do whatever they want. And I think that's really, really empowering. And of course, at the Atlanta Music Project, 95% of our students are African American. So we have to be very, very intentional about what kind of repertoire we have our kids playing. So of course, we'll teach them Mozart, Beethoven, but we also do pop music, and we also do jazz, and we also do spirituals. In fact, last year, we did an entire concert of only black music, music from the Caribbean, music from Africa, music from black America. So we don't, it's really about giving them the power to do what they want, but also being mindful of where we are teaching, being mindful of the culture of our students, and being mindful of the diversity that's available in music.
Sure. Let's actually listen to some other kinds of music that your kids do. You've got a choral group called Amplify. Amplify Zabin is the name of this choir, performing a choral arrangement of the Andra Day song, Rise Up. That's nice, Dante. Do you do that arrangement yourself?
No, I did not. I will give all credit to our director of choirs, Aisha Moody, and our choir director, Verena Lucia Anders. I'll stay out of that one, but thank you.
Okay. Rick Robinson, founder of Cut Time Productions in Detroit, sort of a similar question to you. You know, if people aren't finding classical music on their own, is that potentially an indication that it is legitimately not relevant to their cultural identity and their life experience? And, you know, what's the value of pushing it on them?
Well, I find, you know, life is always about how we look at things, how we take things. And while classical music has this past of being European, I mean, just like books, it becomes a universal source of not only inspiration, but self-reflection, as well as getting your voice out. So the ability to read English can lead to being able to write books or articles or rants if we want to. And the same can be said for music. If we pick up this tool off the floor, blow the dust off, it becomes a very powerful tool.
Dante, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would just say that it's really important that when it comes to children, and we don't make any assumptions about them. You know, just because there's an 8-year-old that's growing up in Southwest Atlanta doesn't mean that that child may not be interested in a variety of music genres. Most of our kids, I admit, you know, they love hip hop. But then again, I love hip hop, but I have 2 degrees in classical music and I do it professionally. So I think it's important to expose kids to many different things, and it's okay for them to like more than one genre of music. I mean, it's all good, right? So we just have to be very careful about putting assumptions on students. I think we'd be surprised if we just gave them the chance to try something and then see where, if they like it. If they don't, fine. If they do, great.
Certainly. Have you found ways of integrating hip hop with the classical music that you teach them?
As close we got was last year we did a Bruno Mars piece called Treasure. So not quite hip hop, but I think what would be really cool would be to involve a DJ or obviously an MC. And who knows, that may be in the future.
Are we speaking with Dante Remote? Oh, go ahead.
I've become a composer in the last 12 years or so, and I've found ways of blending hip-hop and urban pop styles with classical just as a composer. And then furthermore, more recently, I've been working with some spoken word artists, some poets, and doing some classical, you know, loops underneath them. So there's plenty of potential for the two cultures to meet.
When you do it, Rick, do you do it in sort of a winking, oh, isn't this juxtaposition amusing, or do you try to keep it sincere?
Well, there's always a certain authenticity that comes with spoken word artists that sure. is missing from instrumental music that has no lyrics or much context. So one hand washes the other, if you will.
That's Rick Robinson, founder of Cut Time Productions, classical music ensemble in Detroit, working to spread classical music to people who might not otherwise hear it. Also with us is Dante Rameau, executive director of the Atlanta Music Project, working to bring classical music to youth of color, primarily in Atlanta. Let me ask both of you, what do you think that the big classical music institutions, the big symphony orchestras, the operas, what could they learn from your experiences in terms of trying to reach a broader audience, Dante?
Go to the people instead of always inviting the people to come to, you know, a mega structure in the middle of the city.
So you mean physically go to them?
Absolutely. I think you have to, if you want to reach people, you have to give them the honor of meeting them where they are, and then sharing the music in a way that is that makes sense for that community. So, for example, with the Atlanta Music Project, we make sure that we are in recreation centers. We have great partnerships with the city of Atlanta and some Atlanta public schools as well. And we make sure that we're in the neighborhood after school where the kids need a place to go that's safe. We also make sure that we partner with other groups that provide homework and that provide a warm dinner after our classes. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to look at the community that you're trying to reach and kind of do the work, the research, and fit yourself into that community. Obviously, the music doesn't change, but it's the way you approach it that I think needs to be thought out a little bit more.
Rick, same question to you in the last minute that we have. What can the big institutions in classical music learn from what you're doing in terms of trying to reach a broader audience?
Well, I found that going out into the communities means standing in the middle sometimes to try to be that central pillar on the bridge. And for a bridge to be successful, the traffic has to flow in both directions at some points. So before people will actually listen for the value of classical music, often we have to listen to what the community wants to offer us, and they do want to offer us their music. So it's on this bridge, everyone can play well with each other, but it does take some give more than take.
That image of standing in the middle of the bridge playing, it makes me think of another thing that I imagine you probably deal with, which is that classical musicians are used to, in traditional contexts, having everyone be totally silent while they play.
Right.
Have you had to try to get over that expectation, Rick?
And I've successfully done that with amplification. And then keeping people's attention with hosting, a good host who can engage or just act like a DJ who is a member of the family, and just approaches even strangers with agape, you know, a love of humanity, yeah, can bring us together.
Certainly. Rick Robinson, founder of Cut Time Productions. We were also speaking to Dante Rameau, co-founder and executive director of the Atlanta Music Project. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for our show today. We want to hear from you. Is classical music relevant to your life, to your cultural or social identity? Let us know. 404-500-9457. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea.